Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's essential that we do whatever we can to keep the public engaged and interested in this war. One of the roles of every journalist who's there operating is not only to deliver the facts, but to help people connect with the people of Ukraine.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, journalist Sean Rubenstein Dunlop joins Will Stoltz to discuss his recent experiences reporting the war unfolding in Ukraine and the importance of public interest journalism. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging.
So, Sean, thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
So I wanted to speak to you because our audience may know you quite well from their TV screens, seeing your recent reporting from Ukraine. You're really, I suppose, a number of a handful of Australian journalists that have been on the ground there. But you've also been undertaking investigative reporting, including on national security issues for several years now. So there's obviously plenty I'd like to discuss with you. But to start with, would you mind telling us of how your assignment in Ukraine began? And I guess, you know, when did you find out you were heading over there, that sort of thing?
Oh, look, I was sitting in a cafe in Sydney's CBD the day after the Russian invasion. It was 11:30 a.m. and I looked at my phone and I had about 6 missed calls at least from the foreign editor, Dee Porter. And I thought, oh, something is up. I better call her back. She said, are you still interested in going to cover the war in Ukraine? There's a flight at 9:30 p.m. tonight. Can you be on it? And can you let me know within a few minutes if you've got approval from your boss? Because I work for the investigations team, not for our international team. So, of course, I said yes. I'd already told her that I'd be interested in any such opportunity. And then I had about 6 or 7 hours to pack, prepare, and get on a plane, and not a lot of time to actually think about the assignment. So I went into ABC HQ at Ultimo, got fitted for a flak jacket and ballistic helmet, and tested out the gas mask, got my gear sorted, went home, furiously packed, overpacked, as always, but it's an anxiety response for me. And then before I knew it, I was on a plane, which fortunately had Wi-Fi, so I could tie up loose ends on projects that I'd been working on and, get my head across what I was about to, get into.
Yeah.
So we had to hit the ground running. We were in Poland on the Polish side of the Ukrainian border for about 5 days, covering the devastating humanitarian crisis and the inflow of refugees into Poland, which is, I think, more than 2 million now when I last checked, probably way more by the time you run this. So we had 5 days there, and then from there we traveled across the border into Ukraine in the opposite direction to most people, obviously. Everyone's trying to get out of there, but we journalists run towards the crisis. And went in to relieve a very, very tired, Isabella Higgins from her duties and, went from there.
So, you know, in that kind of whirlwind, that chaos that you're moving into, because this would have been in the early, you know, early days of the initial conflict, you know, how do you prioritize or triage kind of what stories you're going to tell? Like, is it just a process of, you know, what you get to first, or do you go into a conflict zone like Ukraine with a bit of a plan of what stories you want to get out in those initial kind of days of the conflict?
I think it was quite straightforward, really. First, when we were in Poland on the border, the remit was just to cover the growing humanitarian crisis, and it was a story where interviews just landed in your lap, so to speak. You're just at the border meeting people as they come across, and a lot of people really did want to talk. Ukrainians really want to share their stories and want the world to know what's going on. There was no shortage of people and no shortage of things to film. And then going into Ukraine, well, as the lead broadcast correspondent there, your role is to cover the main developments of the war every day. So it's not so much an issue of making a choice rather than choosing what you don't cover. And each day something more horrific seemed to happen. So it wasn't very much of a challenge to decide on what to focus on either. But then, of course, you've got to find the balance between reporting on what's happening far away from you, in places like Mariupol, where no one can go in, or should really, for their own safety, and then balancing that with elements you find closer to you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And I suppose just on that, I guess I'm interested to get your views on those so-called kind of citizen journalists who have rushed into the conflict. And we see kind of an array of different types of people. Like, you know, I've noted a couple of Australian military veterans have gone in, but then you kind of get people who are a bit more kind of disaster tourists going in with a camera and broadcasting to Instagram. I mean, what's your kind of view of that type of activity? Do you think is it helpful because, you know, they're circumventing established media, they're able to get a message out there perhaps quicker, there's no editor over their shoulder or producer? Or do you think there's, you know, other issues that kind of arise with that type of reporting?
Look, I didn't meet any. I didn't come across any face-to-face. Of course, I've seen the work of some of them. I would say that I think that the fact that people are able to film this war on their phones, whether they're citizen journalists or just regular citizens, victims, really changes the dimensions of what we're able to do. And, you know, it's a real problem for the Russians because it's much harder to hide atrocities. And, you know, there's some really powerful phone vision, which has formed the basis of some extraordinary reports, and particularly in places like Mariupol, where there was only one mainstream media team that had to leave. But in terms of going more to the point of your question, I think it just depends a little bit on the citizen journalist. You know, it's can be a really good thing when people can I guess circumvent the established methods and demands of mainstream media. But you know, it can also be very risky if they don't have the same commitment to accuracy or the same ethics, or have an agenda And we're, of course, seeing a lot of disinformation, misinformation on social media, and they can be tools in that as well.
Yeah, I suppose witting or unwitting, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
And kind of on that point, you know, this has probably been one of the most broadcast conflicts ever, really. You know, the density with which we're able to get, information about this conflict from Twitter, live streamed on Instagram, plus the established media. I mean, in that context, I suppose it's been observed that by some analysts that the Ukrainians have been very, very good at kind of winning the information fight, so to speak. For you, does that present a challenge, you know, on the ground doing your job because you're there to report facts in a balanced manner? And I suppose ideally examine both sides of a story. But, you know, both sides are trying to shape what you report, I suppose. They're trying to shape those facts, and you don't necessarily have access to both sides. So, I mean, how do you kind of navigate that, knowing that the environment that you're contributing to, that information environment, is actually kind of part of the fight? That's part of the battle space.
Yeah, it's an enormous challenge. And I think the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is an extraordinarily skilled propagandist. He's a showman, he's a former comedian, actor, and he's done an incredible job at inspiring his people. But there are many times that we have to question the veracity of the information that that his government is putting out. And on the flip side, being in Ukraine not being in Russia, that's a real challenge, you know, not having access to what's going on there, to what people are doing and thinking, and the Western media has pretty much all pulled out of Russia. So I think that inevitably creates real challenges for us. I think the information war is also messing with people's heads a lot in the war zone. People are becoming more paranoid. I noticed that shift just in the space of a few weeks, and, you know, that creates safety risks as well. We had a bit of a tangle with some local people in a village near Yavorov, north of Lviv, so in western Ukraine, where a key Ukrainian military base was struck by missiles. It was a base where NATO forces had trained the Ukrainian military for many years, and where the Foreign Legion, so a legion of foreign fighters, was based as well. And the locals in that village accused us of being Russian spies.
Oh, right.
It was a little bit hairy, frankly. And no matter what accreditation we showed them, or even, a story of mine from the news in Ukraine, they didn't believe us. So I think that changes the dimensions for journalists, and makes it potentially very risky when anyone could be a spy. And so we're in the early stages of this war, and I think that information battle is just going to get more and more intense as time goes on. And we as journalists will be questioned and, subject to misinformation campaigns. But that just makes it all the more important that we check our facts, that we uphold the standards we hold dear. And also that we are upfront with the audience when we can't confirm claims.
Yeah.
Again, in Mariupol, when a local official is saying, describing a scene or explaining what's happened, it's crucial for us to say, well, we couldn't independently confirm this.
The intense focus that the media has had on this conflict has actually been a really pivotal part to generating the swift political action to respond to it in a way, because ordinary people are consuming it so intensely. Do you see, therefore, the media as having a responsibility to keep our attention on the conflict in that way? Or do you think, you know, as often happens with so many international crises, as it shifts, as it kind of moves into a different phase and potentially kind of slips from the headlines, you know, do you see a responsibility to keep bringing it back into focus? Or is it just, you know, once the audience stops paying attention, you move with the audience?
It's essential that we do whatever we can to keep the public engaged and interested in this war. You know, it's just an enormous story. And I think at the moment we're in that kind of shock phase where people are deeply interested and paying great attention. And that's increased by the fact that, you know, that Russia is responsible for increasingly horrific attacks. It's like reporting on many, many terrorist attacks every single day. And that keeps the public very engaged for now. I'd also say that there are just some extraordinary camera operators and photographers working in Ukraine right now, and they are filming such intimate, gripping, shocking vision and interviews where I don't think the public has ever been able to feel so in the midst of what's going on as they are right now. And they're filming really raw interviews with people who are going through it, you know, at great risk, at great risk to themselves. So that has really aided us in our efforts to keep people engaged and to care. But I think that, you know, one of my roles as a correspondent there, one of the roles of every journalist who's there operating, is not only to deliver the facts, but to help people connect with the people of Ukraine, with the soldiers of both countries, and try to transmit some empathy all the way across to Australia. I think that's a critical role that we undertake as observers bearing witness to this.
Yeah, and I suppose we can actually kind of think of the tangible impacts of that. You know, we're recording this in London, and it's been interesting. You know, you go into so many different shops and there's a bucket there raising money for Ukraine, and then you see the stories of so many people across Europe who are letting in Ukrainian refugees into their homes, you know, in Italy or in Poland and elsewhere in Moldova. And you do wonder, you're like, yeah, if it wasn't for the fact that this story was being told in such a gripping, visceral way, would people be as kind of emotionally engaged and committed into this conflict as they are? So, yeah, I think you can kind of see the fruits of your good labour all around us.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the work of British media, you know, like the BBC and Sky and Channel 4, has really made a difference in the UK government's stance towards Ukrainian refugees, for example. And I think that in delivering this news with empathy, it doesn't decrease your objectivity, but is a means of delivering humanity, you know, allowing humans across the world to connect with this situation.
We'll be right back.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
So I want to move now, I guess, to your kind of wider reporting on, you know, national security, law enforcement, kind of foreign affairs issues, which will be very interesting to, you know, our audience. You know, because I understand that as an investigative journalist, that's where you've done a lot of your work. So I suppose without kind of asking you to divulge anything about the individuals, of course, that you've interacted with, but I was wondering if you might be able to explain how you go about working with sources for these types of sensitive kind of themes. You know, is it difficult to get people to speak with you when you are doing a story on, you know, I know you've done some things on the law enforcement community or on national security issues?
Yeah, it's very difficult. These are areas shrouded in great secrecy. And where there are a lot of people who want to keep it that way. But you know, you find many who believe there are issues that need to be uncovered. So, I guess in terms of developing sources, you know, once you have a subject area, you just go about, developing that contact book. And often through doing stories, you develop more and more. And I think, you know, one of the key ways to then find stories is to keep in contact with those people, talk to them regularly, demonstrate through your work that you're someone that they can trust. Suddenly they start telling you things. I started, I guess one of my early reporting jobs was as a police reporter for the ABC based in Sydney. So that was how I developed my law enforcement contacts there. And it was having around, it was a great way to do that because, you know, every day you have an opportunity to add a new couple of people to your contact list. And from there, I did a lot of reporting on Islamic State and terrorism. It was sort of a natural progression, which allowed me to develop contacts in the national security community. So that just develops over time. It wasn't anything particularly intentional, but I do think it's so much harder to find stories and when you're operating in with subject matter where you don't have that contact book. It's still absolutely worth doing, and I regularly try to do stories that are outside my kind of comfort zone because, one, I get bored easily, but two, I just want to keep broadening my expertise and knowledge base. But you certainly notice the difference when someone picks up the phone and has no idea who you are.
Yeah. So typically speaking, I suppose those people who are willing to work with you on a story and might be the people that are kind of want to remain confidential and not be in front of the camera. Are there consistent motivations for those people that you discover, or is it usually kind of fairly case by case as to why someone's willing to speak to you?
I mean, you get the people who are just very motivated to share something specific with you, something that they think was perhaps unjust, or something where they just think the public needs to know. You know, it can also fit into people's or an organization's agenda around what they think needs to be part of the national conversation, and they can't do that publicly. And of course, you then, you then balance that against your own assessment of whether it's in the public interest. Other people, you just get certain personality types. You know, everyone knows someone in the workplace that loves to have a gab, loves to gossip, enjoys the attention, perhaps. Those are all great personality traits. So sometimes you just come across people who like to chat, and they're often great sources, but are often, you know, sharing things out of a sense of their own ethics as well. So it's certainly no criticism.
And I suppose it's a bit of a balancing act where you, like, is it the case that you kind of have to think deeply about the motivations of the sources that are coming to you, and sometimes potentially kind of balance out what they're telling you by, you know, going and speaking to someone else and adding a little bit of information? Do you kind of have to scrutinize them a bit?
I think you always have to think about people's motivations, and you sometimes don't know what you're being drawn into, what the bigger game might be for, or game plan might be for that person. But ultimately, I think no matter what someone's motive is, if it's a story that needs to be told, so be it. And you of course need to, you need to find multiple sources. You need to balance their perspective against others with people you talk to. But I think, my motive is to uncover stories that are in the public interest. Their motive might be completely different. But if it's a story that people need to know, then it's as simple as that, in my view.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. It's often said by some observers that the Australian national security community has a kind of higher level of secrecy than even its, you know, American and British counterparts. And sometimes you observe US media, for example, you know, you can see stories where, you know, they're quoting sources from the CIA and these sorts of things. Would you agree, do you think, broadly with that assessment that Australia's culture for these agencies is perhaps a little bit more closed off?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And frankly, not just for those agencies, but for the entire public service. I think people are very scared or wary of speaking out, even doing so anonymously. And, it doesn't help that we see whistleblowers targeted as criminals under the law, and we have extremely strict secrecy provisions in our legislation. I don't think there's a culture of openness in our public service and in our security agencies, of course. And I think that's to the nation's detriment.
Mm. Yeah, I think that there's a need for agencies to be perhaps more proactive and creative in the way they engage with the media. You know, we saw last year head of MI6 here in the UK, you know, made a speech saying that MI6 needed to be more open to remain secret, you know, in its engagement. So maybe there'll be a cultural step change that we might see happen in Australia one day soon.
Yeah, and we, you know, we are seeing, we have seen ASIO, through Mike Burgess, engaging more publicly. you know, looks like that's happening with other agencies as well. But of course, there's every risk for them of that backfiring. And, and you know, we saw the way that, you know, the speech about the election plot recently was used by politicians, and you know, we saw the way that Mike Burgess was, you know, drawn into that and tried to, I guess, regain control of that narrative, or was required then to do some more talking to so that his statements weren't politicized. So, you know, obviously, obviously there are risks from their perspective too. But I think the more that Australians can learn about what's really going on, and the more journalists can be helped to help them do that, the more, you know, the more educated they are in making their choices, decisions, assessments about what they need to worry about.
Yeah, and I suppose it goes to that, the transparency that, that journalists provide to society. So, I mean, kind of touching on that, we've had a debate in Australia, I suppose, in recent years concerning national security reporting and kind of how we get that balance right on, you know, on the one hand, the public interest imperative to tell people what's going on, but versus the kind of national interest that's often used to kind of keep things a little bit more secret and confidential. You know, do you kind of have a philosophy or kind of ethical measure of, in your own mind about kind of how you make this judgment between what is in the public interest versus what is in, you know, worth being kept secret? You know, and typically, I suppose, within your team, within the ABC, you know, how does that kind of decision get considered? Like, if you've got a story where you're kind of balancing up and saying this potentially is a strong public interest, but there is potentially like a national security dimension to this and there could be ramifications, you know, how do you weigh that up?
Well, it's not my job to keep things secret. quite the opposite. I think the only times when we really do that is when someone says to us, you know, from an agency, what the clear risks are. You know, if it's a risk to someone's safety, if it undermines an operation, but, you know, we can report on the operation when it's done. Those are things we might hold back on doing right away. But, you know, generally, my priority is to tell Australians, what's actually happening. So there are times when you're encouraged to not report something, but the reasons are very vague. Those aren't things we'll agree to. It has to be quite clear, and quite a lot of honesty is required from the agency or police force or whatever to us about the reasons why we couldn't do something.
So you'd probably like to see a little bit more of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, for example, one of my colleagues on the investigations team, Elise Worthington, did a Four Corners story last year about a cult, and the cult leader was arrested by the AFP thanks to the evidence that she had gathered and that her team had gathered. And, you know, she held off on reporting the story until after his arrest. So it definitely happens, but you know, a vague fear that it's going to undermine security isn't really good enough.
Yeah, and I suppose there's probably quite a lot of stories that, you know, the vast majority of the time you can still report it in some way, shape, or form, without it compromising you know, safety or a security issue? This kind of
I think it depends on the story. It totally depends on the story. And then there are many that we just can't tell because of the severity of the legislation.
Right.
You know, say like someone who's has been involved in an intelligence operation and as an informant, for example, and wants to talk, you know, they would be doing so. Doing so, they'd be accepting the risk that they might go to jail for a long time. So we're prohibited by a lot of legislation, and you know, defamation law is another one that limits us quite a lot.
Well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, and I am really appreciative that you've taken the time to speak to me and our audience, because I know this is your recuperation time before you go back to Ukraine, potentially for kind of an undefined period of time as you continue to cover this story. So thank you so much for taking time to speak with me. And, you know, please, it's perhaps trite to say it, but please stay safe. You know, wish you all the well, all the best when you return to Ukraine. And thank you for, you know, the public interest journalism that you're doing to bring the story to Australians. I think it's been really valuable. So thanks so much, Sean.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm genuinely humbled by the opportunity to speak with your audience. So thanks very much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.